Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in our era, there's usually too much information about influential people, at least those people who achieve great things. Heroes tend to become celebrities. It's the influential bad actors who tend to stay out of the public view. So it's refreshing and interesting to learn about someone whom hardly anyone has heard about, who had a tremendous positive impact on the history of this country and even the world. Alfred Lee Loomis was a Wall Street lawyer who amassed a huge fortune by financing the growth of the first electric companies, and by anticipating the stock market crash of 1929 and cashing out just in time, then investing heavily in cut-rate stocks that later regained their former value. But on the weekends, he was a closet scientist, a physicist who used his wealth, his contacts, and his talents in business and science to foster and in some cases even personally invent key technologies that became crucial to defeating Nazi Germany in World War II. My guest is Rob Rapley, an Emmy-nominated television writer and producer who's produced several programs for PBS's American Experience series, including, most recently, one on Alfred Loomis entitled The Secret of Tuxedo Park. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. So in reading about Alfred Loomis, he sounds like a true American Renaissance man, highly successful in the law and business and in science, as well as charming and well-connected socially and politically. He accomplished more in more fields than almost anyone I'm aware of in recent American history. But I'll admit, as much as I know about the history of science, for one thing, I'll admit I'd never heard of him. So why don't you start by giving us a broad overview of his life and accomplishments, and then we'll get into the specifics later.
Sure. Well, Loomis, kind of a real-world Bruce Wayne character. He grew up in an upper-class family in New York that had fallen on hard times, in large part because of his father's bad behavior. He'd squandered their money. And he took refuge in science. It was his solace in the midst of a rather chaotic upbringing. But he couldn't follow that calling because his father died young, and Loomis, a career in science wasn't going to support the family that Loomis now had responsibility for. It wasn't just that he liked science. He had really a phenomenal aptitude. And, you know, for those of us who aren't scientifically inclined, it's kind of hard to get a feel for that. But one thing that makes it tangible is his aptitude for chess. Even as a child, he was kind of a prodigy, and he developed the ability to play chess without seeing the board. He could play it blindfolded and just remember where all the pieces were. And before the age, around the age of 10, he was able to do this with several games simultaneously. So he could play two, three opponents blindfolded and never lose. So it gives you some sense of what his mind was like. In any case, he's saddled with responsibility for his mother and sisters. And so he goes off to Wall Street. He studies law. He goes off to Wall Street and makes an enormous fortune. Enough that by the mid-1920s, he was in fact free to pursue science without worrying about money. He continued to work, but as you mentioned, on the weekends and the evenings, he was doing the science literally in his garage at the beginning. He starts small, but eventually builds up a world-class lab in the basement of his mansion in Tuxedo Park outside New York City. So he and his colleagues, they did a bunch of groundbreaking scientific research, and they invented things that some of which we still use today. But as the 1930s were progressing, by this time he was very kind of tied into the scientific community, the worldwide scientific community, including a lot of refugees from Nazi Germany who were coming to the United States through the 1930s. And Loomis got very concerned that the U.S. and its allies weren't ready for what was coming, and that they would be overwhelmed by the Nazis' technological edge, because they were sinking vast sums of money into basically military scientific research. So he devoted all of his energies to overcoming that technological edge, and he focused his work on a new field, radar, and he ended up leading the American radar program through the Second World War. Even though I'm kind of a Second World War buff, I was amazed to learn just how crucial radar was, that as they said back then, that the bomb only ended the war, that radar won it.
I mean, it's very unusual for a successful businessman, and as I mentioned, by the middle of the Depression, he had multiplied his fortune by being savvy enough to cash out just before the House of Cards fell in, and then buying into the House of Cards as it got built again later, and so he wanted to expand his operation. I mentioned that the title of your recent American Experience program was The Secret of Tuxedo Park, and he lived in Tuxedo Park, New York. That's where his mansion was, but I think he looked around. He wanted to expand beyond his garage operation, right? Tell us about the house he bought and the labs he built there.
The operation was outgrowing his garage. So he bought a mansion that had been vacant for many years and it become dilapidated and become the setting for a lot of ghost stories that nannies told the children in the Tuxedo Park. And he began converting it to a laboratory. So he wasn't living there. He had a separate home. But the basement was the laboratory itself. And because he had this vast fortune, he could afford the best equipment in the world. And one of his real aptitudes was designing and making very precise instruments. As I say, money was no object. The ground floors were the offices for various people. And then upstairs was this staggeringly beautiful mansion, the guest quarters really for visiting scientists that he had from around the world. And of course, scientists are human too. And so they were drawn to this place. You know, why wouldn't you want to go to a place where you had a liveried servant standing behind every diner at these great meals that he put on? So the evenings and the recreation was very sumptuous, but they were doing very, very serious work in the basement of this place.
Yeah, but the main thing was the quality of the laboratory facilities, as you mentioned. I mean, it's the Depression, and his place was outfitted better than almost any university lab in the country. So not only was it a sumptuous place to go to, but people could dive into equipment that they could only dream about back at Stanford or Harvard or whatever it might be. You know, somebody like Albert Einstein, for example, going there referred to it as the Palace of Science, I saw. So it was all of that. From the outside, it didn't look like a scientific laboratory at all. It looked like a sumptuous mansion. And I guess you talked about the liveried servants and so on, but he would pick these scientists up, and many of them kind of refugees almost from Nazi Germany in the early days before the war really got going. And, you know, Jewish scientists coming in who had no money, you know, and were kind of, you know, living on scraps back where they came from practically. And he would pick them up at the airport or the railroad station in his limousine or his Rolls Royce and chauffeur them to his place through this lavish subdivision, this really affluent subdivision called Tuxedo Park. So they were probably half intoxicated by the time they got there. It must have been quite an experience.
I think it was like going to heaven for them, you know, apart from the refugees, young scientists coming from underfunded universities in the middle of the Great Depression. And he actually paid the train line to have the trains make a special stop at Tuxedo Park so that you know, this one guy would get off the train. And as you mentioned, his limousine would pick them up and drive them through the stone gates of this gated community for the affluent, and driving by all these mansions. And then they pulls up to this mansion, and the butler gets out to lead you into the place. And I think they thought they'd died and gone to heaven. And when they got to work, they had the best equipment anywhere.
Yeah, so kind of along the lines, I guess maybe their first impression for a lot of them who didn't know much about him when they were summoned or invited to come and were encouraged to come by their colleagues who'd been there maybe was that this guy was some kind of rich dilettante or dabbler. But I think they quickly came to realize that he was a very serious scientist, almost on the level of some of the greatest physicists and scientific minds in the world. That appeared to be true, right?
He could absolutely keep up with the best of them. And I'm sure that he developed himself. You know, he had no scientific training. If he'd had proper scientific training, I think there's no doubt that he could have been a
world-class.
One of the world-class scientists, absolutely. He was even without the training. At first, the relationship tended to be, you know, is there something you want to investigate, something that costs a lot of money? We could team up. I can pay for it and work with you. That's how it worked. But as time went on, it was more and more of an equal partnership. And he became close friends, genuine friends with some of the best scientists in the world, you know, Ernest Lawrence and Niels Bohr, you know, names that we still know. And they were genuinely friends and colleagues of his.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Rob Rapley, who is writer and director, most recently, of a show on PBS's American Experience series called The Secret of Tuxedo Park. And we're talking about that secret because what went on there at Tuxedo Park was world-class scientific work that was basically a secret to everyone around because the owner and kind of impresario of this whole operation, Alfred Lee Loomis, was secretive and had no interest in publicity, and he had the world by the tail, and he didn't really need people knocking on his door wanting to do interviews, and so he was quite low profile about the whole thing. You had mentioned, Rob, earlier that he was aware, partly through his contact with the European scientists who were coming to his place, he was aware more acutely than many people in even the U.S. government about the dire threat that Nazi Germany posed to the future of the world. And we were at the time, we being Americans in general and even the government, were very much non-interventionist, right? It was like America first, and they were sick of World War I, which was still in fairly recent memory. Didn't want to do that again.
Absolutely.
And he was aware that we needed to do that again because these people were going to roll over Britain and then possibly us after that if we weren't prepared. So what happened to, you know, how did he begin to grease the skids or the wheels to get things turning under the surface to move forward with the kind of scientific discovery and innovation that you were talking about that led to military weapons that could defeat Germany?
He was very well connected. You know, he'd been one of the reasons that he was an interventionist early on was because he traveled a lot. He went to Europe frequently on these tours, and he would basically go around and visit with the leading scientists of the world. And so he saw Nazi Germany with his own eyes. He was there several times, and he was appalled by what he saw. When the Germans banned Jews from teaching in universities or holding any significant post, that was a wake-up call for him, according to his descendants. They were, of course, being many of them leaving the country and ending up in America, and he helped bring some of them across. And he used that network of emigre scientists in part to find out what was going on in Nazi Germany, and specifically in nuclear research. That this was something that particularly terrified him. He was among the first people to learn of it because of his connections. And he then kind of started this operation to poll emigre scientists and find out what was going on in Nazi Germany behind the veil of secrecy there. And then he determined that he wanted to use his lab, which had been doing, you know, there were always 3, 4, 5 things going on at once, a variety of projects. And he decided that he was going to focus it on one thing only, but he didn't know what that would be yet. And again, through his network of friends and connections, one of them was the head of MIT, and they were doing some work there on something called microwave radar. And it's kind of dorky, but the essential point is simply that there are two kinds of radar. The early kind is long wave, the later kind is short wave. The long wave means you need big, big antennas and stuff in the buildings that they had, like in Britain during the Battle of Britain. The microwave radar, which was the future, but that nobody had managed to build yet, was going to be something small that you could fit in a plane or a ship, and it was obviously going to, you know, transform the fortunes of any military that had it. Nobody knew how to build it yet, but that became his focus, how to build this. And he devoted all of his resources to this. And he was working 7 days a week, and he was teaming up with people like Ernest Lawrence and working with them. And there was one specific hurdle, which was to build a generator capable of generating these microwaves to microwave radar. And this kind of followed on some of the work that he'd been doing in the 30s. He'd invented a device that became the ultrasound, you know, which basically works on high frequency waves. He'd invented something that would later become the microwave. So this drew on that. But there was this one hurdle that nobody could get past, which was building a microwave generator. And this is what he was working on through 1939. So even before the war started in Europe, he was really following a rather lonely course. Nobody else was too interested in this. He was dragging some of his friends into it, but there really wasn't much interest in the United States in this work, and he was desperately trying to get anybody interested in it. But he was unable to get past this hurdle on his own. He was making some progress, but he couldn't really get past it to the point of making a viable, you know, device that the military could use in combat.
Yeah, I gather that the big problem with the microwave radar was getting a generator that was strong enough. And so he had developed his team, and he had put together a crude microwave radar, but it was very very weak, and so I thought it was kind of funny. They deployed it in the back of a van and went over and parked at a golf course and would try to track the players and then the cars going by and that kind of thing. And then they ran over to a local airport and were trying to image the airplanes coming into the airport, but it was just very weak. And so, you know, you mentioned that was the barrier that kept this from being a usable military tool, which it became. It was clear that it could become vital and like a game changer, but they couldn't get over that barrier. So what happened to get them past that hurdle?
This is one of the most amazing and little known chapters of the war. And it's a period that's now being popularized in movies like The Darkest Hour and Dunkirk, when Britain was on its own facing Germany and desperately trying to get America involved in the war. That it looked like the Nazis were going to invade any day, and Britain's odds of survival were, less than even. Britain had been investing heavily in military research just for the last couple of years before the war, when they finally got nervous about the Nazi threat. And they had made several important discoveries and developments, including things like jet engines and various technologies that would later come to fruition. And one of them was exactly this thing. It was a microwave generator of incredible power, you know, more than enough to build a microwave radar device. And so there were all these kind of discussions in the British government, like, you know, should we kind of negotiate with the Americans and try and trade off? And Churchill finally said in the summer, when things were that desperate, he said, look, let's just give it to them. Give them everything. You know, no, for just for nothing. And his hope, of course, was that the trust would be reciprocated and it would form the basis of an alliance. And in the worst case, if Britain did lose the war, at least somebody would be prepared. You know, America was going to have to fight Germany someday, and at least they'd have the advantage of having these weapons. So they send over a secret mission and, I forget, a dozen military men and scientists with all these, the secrets to all these technologies, all the drawings and charts and plans and some prototypes. And Loomis and others are summoned to Washington to meet these people. They have no idea what is up. The night before the first meeting is supposed to happen, Loomis invites everybody to his huge, mammoth, luxurious hotel suite down the road from the White House. And they all meet there, and the British unveil kind of quietly to him that they have this thing. They've done it. And he's floored. He's been working desperately to get to develop this thing for 2 years or so now. And here it is. And Britain, this is in the middle, at the height of the Battle of Britain. It's looking that the whole thing is hanging in the balance. And here is a device that, as they said at the time, might be the salvation of the Allied cause. And so this is where he really became the right man in the right place.
Yeah, so it was kind of the holy grail, this thing called the cavity magnetron, which was, you know, small. It could sit easily on a table. And so it made it possible then to make radars not only that would be in big installations on the coast where you could see, you know, fleets of planes coming in at a distance, but also to mount in the nose of a fighter plane, you know, just a small fighter plane of the era. And so suddenly that was a massive advance in technology that gave the Allies a great advantage. At that point, then, I guess Loomis had developed a relationship with President Roosevelt and basically moved his Tuxedo Park operations to Cambridge, to MIT, established something that became known as the Radiation Laboratory, or later the Rad Lab, but it still exists today and has been just basically a generator of super useful inventions ever since, right? So he was the guy who more or less established and funded that thing, and his key was, with all his money, he could pump money into something as bridge funding until the government and the Congress would get around to passing laws and appropriating the funds to take over and put money into it. But this is a guy who was functioning almost as a one-man, National Science Foundation or something for a while. So the Rad Lab, what happened there?
Well, that's exactly right. It's in the summer of 1940, Roosevelt is finally, after France has fallen and Britain is standing alone, Roosevelt forms a scientific board really to oversee the development of military technology. Finally, the government kind of wakes up. And Loomis is now the leading authority on microwave radar. And so he is appointed by the president to lead up the microwave radar program. So when this cavity magnetron shows up a couple of months later, and it still sounds like a Flash Gordon device to me, he is in a position to do something about it. There still isn't a ton of money, but everybody, you know, the country's awake to the threat now, even though we're not at war. And he is given responsibility for implementing, you know, here it is. You've got the technology. You've got all the pieces. Now the last piece of the puzzle is here. We need to now make this into actual devices that can be used in war, like the actual thing that will go in the fighter plane or the ship or the tank or the artillery shell ultimately. But you have to build up the scientific establishment to invent these things and oversee the manufacturing even of these things. And he does put up a little bit of money. He briefly lends money, but by this time the government's involved and it's beginning to dwarf even his vast fortunes. You know, if his fortune, I think, by this time was about $50 million, which is a staggering sum at that time. Ultimately, the Rad Lab will be cost over $1 billion. Mm. And it's several times the size even of Los Alamos and the atomic bomb project. But what he does is he sits down next day with some of his scientific friends, including Ernest Lawrence, the pioneering nuclear physicist, and they start making calls. And this is the only military game in town yet. You know, there's no atomic bomb program, so this is the one. And they're calling people, and I forget how many future Nobel Prize laureates there are in this crowd, but I think it's around 8 or 10. They call them and they say, you know, we need you to work on this really important project. And people say, what project? And say, well, it's just important. You know, Loomis is doing it and Lawrence is doing it. And that was enough. People would come and sign up. And they established a lab. Obviously, it was going to be far bigger than could fit in the basement of his mansion at Tuxedo Park. And so they decided to house it at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in part because it was one of the few places in the country where an operation of this size might be concealed. You know, this was going to be a large operation, mm-hmm. and they wanted some secrecy. So they had all these scientists pouring in and this money, and they hired a manager, Lee Dubridge, to run the operation. And Loomis sets out the basic priorities. Okay, we're going to work on an airborne radar and, you know, this and that, and a navigation system. Those are the three things. Go. And they kind of set this immense operation and they create it and set it into motion.
Let's talk for a minute about the range of his inventions. I mean, I read a list of Loomis's patents and papers, and it's like reviewing Leonardo da Vinci's work on a smaller scale but more modern. It's so broad and diverse. I mean, it's mind-boggling, the things he got into. I mean, just within the scope of radar, we talked about, you know, the microwave radar. We talked about aircraft radar, and there were radar beacons you could drop on the ground that could then home in paratroopers, for example, could drop, you know, in the right place. And there was a landing craft control so that LSTs could land on a beach in the middle of, you know, humongous amounts of artillery fire and everything, you know, all hell breaking loose, and could land in the right spot. And there were radar-directed guns, which was very important. Instead of firing more or less blindly in the direction of targets, you could really lock on to a target and take it out with, you know, one or two shots, that kind of thing. So those made a huge difference. But, I mean, one thing that amazed me is someone who's gone offshore fishing many times in the era before GPS, and what we used then was LORAN, and it was used for decades, LORAN. I had no idea what it stood for, but it turns out it stands for Loomis Radio Navigation. So, I mean, this guy invented LORAN. And as you mentioned, there was a gun muzzle velocity invention that he did early on when he was like a young man. And in World War I, actually, that was key to a lot of things, because you could then measure the velocity of shells coming out of an artillery piece and therefore determine how far they were going to go. And you could adjust then the angle of it to land where you wanted to land, so it greatly improved the accuracy of fire of artillery. And just, you know, you mentioned ultrasound. I mean, it was the basis of today's ultrasound that people look at their fetuses in the womb with, and lots of other things in medicine, and the microwave oven, and you know, gosh, the microscope centrifuge, which is a thing that's used in research. And, you know, but he got into biology. I mean, tell us about, you know, the sleep brainwave research just briefly, where he used someone in his family as a research subject.
Yeah, it really does demonstrate the breadth of his work, because, you know, this is really off in another direction entirely, but it illustrates his knack for building precise instrumentation. This is one of the things that he was very good at, because other people had suggested that there were stages of sleep and that the brain emitted brain waves, basically, that you could measure. People had tried to measure them. They hadn't been able to do anything consistent. And so they'd said, oh, this is not true. This is just doesn't measure up. There's no way of proving this. Loomis just said, you know what, your instruments aren't good enough. And so he set about designing a more precise measuring instrument. And it shows how kind of improvised these things were. He got his son, who had a knack for falling asleep under any conditions, and the pictures are incredible because he has all these sensors wired to his head and body, and he's in this little room in the basement, and he would manage to fall asleep, and they would just measure through these sensors his brain waves, and they categorized the stages of sleep as a result. And it was the first time that was done, and it's science that still stands up today, and it's really remarkable. It's just miles away from, you know, Loran or the muzzle velocity chronograph and so on. It just shows you how kind of flexible he was, and how widely he ranged in his interests.
And he pioneered techniques for electroencephalography, which, you know, I'm glad I said that right, which was, you know, became the EEG, right? So they wire you up and measure your brain waves and that kind of thing. But, I mean, basically, to show you how strong genes can run in a family, one of his children, Henry Loomis, became the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the CPB, which is the entity that funds PBS, right? And so one of his great-grandsons, Reed Hastings, is co-founder of Netflix. I mean, and Loomis and his brother-in-law opened Hilton Head. There's a little real estate sideline. They bought up much of what became Hilton Head Island and opened that up. So, I mean, unbelievable. Well, anyway, we're just out of time, Rob, and this has been fascinating. But I just want to say that this show, The Secret of Tuxedo Park, was aired on the PBS series American Experience and can be viewed online at pbs.org/show/American-experience. But if you just go to pbs.org, you can find it by looking up The Secret of Tuxedo Park. And it was based on a book by someone named Jeanette Conant. The book is called Tuxedo Park, A Wall Street Tycoon and the Secret Palace of Science That Changed the Course of World War II, which is, of course, what we've been talking about. And Jeanette Conant, the author, is the granddaughter of James Conant, one of the physicists with whom Loomis worked very closely at that time and was a very eminent American scientist himself. So, Rob, this has been fascinating, and I hope all of my listeners out there have enjoyed it as much as I have. So, thanks for being on American Variety.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.